Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott.
Hey, Maiken.
Hey, Alana.
So, I want to show you this picture of this letter.
Okay. It's from the insurance company Aetna, and...
it's got a pretty big envelope window there.
Huge window. Wow. So, it shows way more than the address, and what I'm reading is...
prescriptions.
For HIV medicine.
Yeah, my jaw kind of dropped the first time I saw this envelope.
Who got this letter?
So, a lot of people actually got this letter, including Sam.
So I'm a gay male living with HIV.
Sam is based in New Jersey. He's in his 30s, and he's comfortable with being out about being gay, but his HIV status is really a secret in the sense that his parents don't know. He's not ashamed, but he worries about the cost of that information being public, of people in his profession knowing. He's a lawyer.
I see the discrimination out there, and I also know people's mindsets. If my status was out there, that could affect my ability to obtain clients. That's my issue.
And Sam got one of those letters when?
He got it last summer and from his insurer. And he just, like, he felt like suddenly in that moment, like that secret about his HIV status was out of his control. It was out there in the open because that window to that letter was so big.
I just remember seeing it. And if someone had seen that, they would have seen that I had HIV. Or they would know, rather, that I had HIV. I don't know how to articulate that sense of, like, shock. Just to be exposed like that, I really felt vulnerable.
And so he started imagining these worst-case scenarios. Like, can you imagine, like, what if that letter forwarded to his parents?
Or what if a neighbor saw it?
Exactly. So, Maiken, this secret being exposed, the story doesn't stop there. But I wanted to share that with you to kick off today's show, because today's episode is all about
secrets. And what happens when they come out? What happens next when the cat is out of the bag?
19 years ago, I had a daughter, and I regret becoming her parent.
People that you love got persecuted, and you can be too.
My wife knows absolutely nothing about any of the clients that I see.
Are you more afraid to die than you are to be deported?
Yeah. So on today's episode of The Pulse, we're going to explore what happens next. The secret is out. What now? Before we get to our next stories, Alana Gordon, I do have to know, though, what happened with Sam and this letter?
That was the beginning of a pretty significant story, but... even just a few months after he got that letter, it's still in his mind.
Even thinking about it now, I'm still shocked. I just can't believe that someone's personal information like that could be exposed in such a, like, negligent way.
When a person's HIV status leaves their control, they are then at risk for all types of discrimination and violence.
So this is Rhonda Goldfein, and she's director of the AIDS Law Project of Pennsylvania, and she got involved. Because the problem was much bigger than just Sam's one letter. By August, her office started receiving calls, her and other legal groups, from hundreds of people who'd gotten similar wide-windowed mailers.
We've received about 12 requests for relocation. So these are folks who had to leave their homes because somebody found out they had HIV.
Wow. So was there any consequence for all of this in terms of Aetna?
Yeah. So Aetna at first apologized and actually set up a fund for people who were impacted in this way. But then Rhonda and others realized that it wasn't just even a few hundred people, that up to 12,000 of Aetna's members who take HIV meds, either for the treatment or prevention of HIV, may have gotten similar letters. So this is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And they filed a big lawsuit. And just last month, in January of 2018, Aetna agreed to settle for $17 million
Whoa.
That's no small chunk of change. Actually, many think that that's the largest per person payout of a data breach of any kind, let alone for a medical privacy breach or an HIV privacy breach.
Like on a basic level, I think it's good. You know, it's good.
It sends the message that your personal information is private and it's entitled to be private.
I'm wondering, though, Alana, what is the message that this sends in terms of stigma and whether or not HIV is different from any other illness?
That's something that even Rhonda wrestles with. It's tricky.
When we talk about HIV privacy, I always feel like we're giving a mixed message. Because on one hand, we're saying HIV, it's a virus. Viruses are random. There's no shame in being sick. You know, we want to mainstream HIV. We don't want people to have shame, which fuels the stigma, which fuels the epidemic. So we want to always make that clear. And then we say, but don't let anybody know your status. You know, keep it a secret. And so there's this mixed message of, if it's just a virus, why are we so adamant that information about that virus has to be kept private? And the answer is that HIV discrimination and stigma is running rampant and is fueling the epidemic. And unless we can get a handle on discrimination, then we have to be mindful about privacy.
So, Mike, and when you think about it, especially in the context of today's show of exploring secrets, we all have them. We all have secrets. But ones about our health can be some of the most sensitive.
We're talking about secrets on The Pulse today and what happens when they come out. About 11 million undocumented immigrants live in the United States, and most of them don't have health insurance. That means when there is a serious illness, it's hard to get treatment. But it goes beyond that. Dan Gorenstein, healthcare reporter at Marketplace, brings us the story of one woman, a mom with young kids. She had to choose between getting care for a life-threatening illness and protecting her secret, and with it, her family.
I hope to extend my life as long as possible for the sake of my children.
This is a story about family.
I was told I only had 4 to 6 months to live.
This is a story about what happens when you have no good option.
I wanted to try anything. Maybe a miracle could happen.
This is Jay's story. A 41-year-old mother who emigrated from China 18 years ago. We're not identifying the family, and instead using an initial for Jay because she and her husband are in danger of deportation. The family lives in Queens. All 3 kids are U.S. citizens. Jay was diagnosed with terminal stomach cancer. Last fall, she had a choice. Should she try to enter a drug trial?
You look at these clinical trials, there are some patients who just forget to die.
Steve Lee, Jay's oncologist, works at Bellevue Hospital in Manhattan. He says it would get her access to a potent medicine that researchers want to test on her form of cancer.
This is what we hope for. She could be one of these long-term survivors.
But there was a problem. The only way Jay could get into the drug trial was if she got insurance, specifically Medicaid. To qualify, she'd have to do the last thing an undocumented immigrant would want to do, declare herself to the Department of Homeland Security. It meant stepping out of the shadows, providing her address and the names of everyone she lived with.
Before getting sick, legal status was clearly important, but as it is now, both legal immigration status and my ability to continue to live are intertwined, because I can only get good treatment if I obtain legal status.
To this point, Jay had gotten something known as emergency Medicaid. That's a way in for people who can't qualify for traditional Medicaid to get coverage for a serious illness. And Jay was fortunate. She lives in New York State with one of the most generous programs in the country. UCLA health policy professor Stephen Wall says each state defines emergency differently.
In some states, they say giving you dialysis is keeping you from dying. We're going to put you on emergency Medicaid.
In other states, Georgia's one that comes to mind, they will not put you on emergency Medicaid until you are in diabetic shock.
The little research there is on care for very sick, undocumented immigrants shows that the treatment is so uneven, sometimes it's different from county to county. What people receive is a product of luck. By the time Jay learned about the drug trial, she'd had chemotherapy. She had part of her stomach removed. After the cancer spread into her ovaries, those were taken out. But emergency Medicaid doesn't pay for drug trials. For that, she needed traditional Medicaid, and for that, she needed to appeal to the Trump administration. Jay had hit a wall. She needed to decide if getting that cancer medicine, that one thing that might extend her life, was important enough that she'd be willing to be deported or see her husband deported to maybe break up her family.
Are you more afraid to die than you are to be deported?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd rather die more than deport, yeah. Because my family need me. My children need me.
This is where attorney Domna Antoniadis comes in.
I am a senior staff attorney at the New York Legal Assistance Group.
Domna works just across the hall from Jay's doctor at Bellevue Hospital, and it's her job to help patients jump through the bureaucratic hoops to get health coverage. She says Jay had a compelling case.
She's been here for almost 20 years. She has three young U.S. citizen children. She's never been arrested, no criminal history. She's worked, and right now she has a very aggressive form of cancer.
Jay and her family face this dilemma as the threat of deportation has grown under President Trump. Federal figures show arrests of undocumented people living in the U.S. are up 40% over the previous 12-month period. This was a real risk.
She's saying, here I am, this is what's going on with me, but please don't remove me.
Jay went home to talk with her husband. He'd seen his wife do everything she could, change her diet, walk up hills for exercise, follow doctor's orders. Now it was the drug trial. He says the decision was clear.
Life is more important than anything else. You have to face the cancer. You have to face the pressures. You just have to do whatever it takes so that you can keep on living.
Jay submitted the application. Domna, Jay's attorney, advised the family to be cautious, like if federal agents show up, make sure they've got a warrant before you open the door. She gave Jay a guide outlining her rights in Mandarin. Over the fall, Jay's husband said the family felt vulnerable.
We watch the news. We see the things that Donald Trump says, and we see that he's been tough on immigration and has tried to make a lot of changes. So for sure, we're more worried.
A new fear settled over the family, the kind of balled-up, tight fear that knots your stomach. Life at home shifted. Their 13-year-old daughter did dinner dishes. Their 12-year-old son set the table and played fewer video games, trying to make his mom happy. Their kid sister, just 4 years old, asked why everything was different. Jay talked less. There was one other thing the kids could do, try to bolster Jay's application with Homeland Security.
Dear the most highly respected judge and court, I'm writing this because I love my mom.
This is a letter written by Jay's oldest. We had another teenager read it.
My mom is very important to me. I have no idea what I'd do without her. Even though my mom's afraid, she's not giving up. I remember once she said to me, I'm going to try to live as long as I can. I want to see your sister grow up and get married. Then I'll be content. I don't want to die before that.
It worked. While waiting to hear back from Homeland Security, Jay got word from New York's regular Medicaid program. She got insured. In December, Jay had her first drug trial treatment. Jay says she was trying to savor what she had.
Now I'm not nearly as strict with my kids. I sort of just let them be kids. Before, I'd give them extra homework on top of what was assigned at school. Now I just want them to be happy. Between my husband and me, we care a lot less about money. Before, we would only go out to dinner once a month. Now we treasure every moment we have.
Almost as soon as Jay was in the drug trial, she was out.
Hi, Steve.
Hey, Steve, it's Dan Gorenstein.
Hey.
So what's the update?
So she went to NYU and was found to have a rapid growth of her cancer.
By early January, Jay had started hospice. The care she gets at this point is to make her as comfortable as possible. Jay's lawyer says it's unlikely she'll live long enough to get deported. But this new heightened risk for her husband won't go away. And he'll be on his own to figure out what that means for him and their kids. I asked oncologist Steve Lee if he thought the trial was worth all the risks and stress.
I think it's easier to say that going on the drug trial was a waste of time in retrospect. But the alternative for a cancer like this is that she would invariably die. So I think that the opportunity to give her a shot at long-term survival was one worth putting a lot on the line for.
Lee says what the trial really gave Jay and the whole family was hope. Living in the U.S., that's something few undocumented immigrants as sick as Jay ever get.
That was Dan Gorenstein. He reports on healthcare for Marketplace. We're talking about secrets today and what happens when they come out. Our next story is about a sweet secret, one that friends kept to bring joy to a grieving family. Erica Lance has this story.
As a young boy in Mechanicsville, Virginia, Nate Matheny had a habit of disappearing.
Nate had a tendency to wander. He'd sneak out the back door if you didn't keep an eye on him, and he would go onto people's front porches and if they had wind chimes, he would just stand under their wind chimes and listen to the wind chimes chime.
That's Nate's dad, Kevin Matheny. Nate was always drawn to sound, partly because he had Williams syndrome. It's a genetic condition that involves developmental delays and heart problems, and people with Williams syndrome often have hypersensitive hearing. At 6 years old, Nate couldn't talk, but he sang or hummed almost all the time. One day, Nate seemed irritable. He couldn't use words to tell his parents what was wrong, but clearly something was. That evening, his parents looked at the couch, and Nate wasn't humming. In fact, he wasn't moving. His lips had turned blue. Nate's sister, Caroline, was 9 years old at the time and remembers it clearly.
I just got back home from my daycare after school, and I was watching Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and, like, my parents started freaking out because they realized that he wasn't breathing.
Her parents rushed him to the hospital as word about Nate spread through town.
I was at dinner at Applebee's with my family of five going through my Facebook feed.
Tamara Letter knew Nate's mom, Diane, in high school.
I saw Diane post a request for prayer. Nate's heart had stopped, and they were trying to revive him. And we placed our orders at our restaurant, and my world continued on, and her world completely stopped.
The local hospital tried to prep Nate to take a helicopter ambulance, but they couldn't seem to stabilize him. And after just a few hours, Nate died. Nate's older sister, Caitlin, remembers seeing their dad the next day. For years, he'd given Nate his morning meds.
He woke up really early and he's like, what do I do with my mornings now? I just remember actually seeing him cry for the first time and him just looking desperate for what to do next.
3 days later, Tamara, that woman at Applebee's, was at Nate's wake, thinking of his mother, Diane.
I felt the weight of that loss and it just felt so heavy. I wanted to help, but I didn't know how.
She mentioned this to another woman, and as the two of them stood next to Nate's casket, they formed a plan. They decided that, for 1 year, they would shower Diane's family with anonymous acts of kindness, and they'd recruit other women in different corners of Diane's life to join them.
We created a Facebook group. I chose five ladies, and Michelle chose five ladies. That was it.
They called themselves the Secret Sisters. Each of the 12 women was assigned a month, and for that month, they'd commit to three things. Pray pray for Nate's family every day, send small gestures of love throughout the month, and give one larger gift, all anonymously. Nate's parents remember getting that first card, signed from the Secret Sisters.
We immediately began investigating as to who these people were.
That looks like so-and-so's handwriting.
And thus began the stream of anonymous notes and gifts from the Secret Sisters. Tamara says she and the others usually made deliveries under the cover of darkness.
I was terrified that I would drive by their house and they would recognize my car. You know, when was the last time you ding-dong ditched somebody as a 40-year-old?
It was always a joy getting ready to go out the door, and all of a sudden it's like, whoa, there's a basket on the front porch, or there's something hidden in the mailbox, or there's something
on
the hood of the car.
Yeah. They were really creative.
The family was given crafts, food, and gift cards to movies and bowling alleys and restaurants, things to distract them from their grief. It touched Diane that these mysterious givers knew her son so well. For example, Diane received one gift in particular that reflected Nate's obsession with ladybugs. She opened the package to see a set of wind chimes, just like the ones Nate used to wander off to find. Small ladybugs dangled among the chimes.
I just started crying. I mean, it was joy mixed with grief. Nate was still being remembered.
A year after Nate's death, his family received a large stuffed envelope from the Secret Sisters.
We're like, oh, what's it going to be now? And it was a puzzle.
When they put the jigsaw together, they saw an invitation to a picnic at the park. It was finally time to meet the Secret Sisters. The day of the party, the 12 women from different parts of Diane's life gathered nervously under a shelter at the park, waiting to finally reveal themselves. Then Diane and her family arrived.
They got out of their car and they scanned across and saw all of us standing there. It really was an overwhelming moment. We all pretty much were in tears.
Then they reminisced together about a year that had turned from terrible sadness to deep joy.
It was the best thing that could come out of a horrible situation.
Erica Lance reported this story. A longer version of it was featured on the WBUR podcast, Kind World. Therapists hear and keep lots of secrets. That's part of their job. But there are times when they are legally obligated to let others know about something they've heard in a session. I talked about this with psychologist Charles Jacob. He specializes in family and couples counseling.
I think that one of the main reasons that psychotherapy continues to exist, you know, 100 years out, is the basis of confidentiality. I mean, it's a big, big deal. There's just so few areas of life where you're granted something like that, that whatever I tell this person is going to stay here. And I think most of us, myself included, we're pretty ardent defenders of this idea of confidentiality. It's a really, really important thing that you offer. I mean, to the point where, you know, it's interesting, like I've been married now for 10 years and my wife knows absolutely nothing about any of the clients that I see.
So it's almost like you're an FBI agent.
Not quite.
Can I ask you, though, are there legal rules that tell you you are not allowed to share the name or the identity or the details? Or is that sort of just a professional oath?
It's written very clearly in the Code of Ethics, either the American Counseling Association, the American Psychological Association, any number of different branches of therapy have that embedded within their codes. There's exceptions, though. You know, anytime you're offered a guarantee in life, there's always some fine print. If a client presents as an imminent threat to themselves, so if a client says to me very clearly that they intend to hurt themselves to the point where it could end their own life, I'm obligated to do something about that. If a client tells me very clearly that they intend to kill someone else, that they intend to harm someone such that it would cause them to end their life, then I'm obligated to do something in that case. Do you remember the show The Sopranos? Right?
Yeah, of course.
It's the one everybody always references. The agreement Tony Soprano had with his psychiatrist was that He could not tell her about crimes that he intended to commit in the future that might end in someone dying, you know?
Can I stop you for a second? I don't know where this story is going. But there are a few ethical ground rules we should quickly get out of the way. What you tell me here falls under doctor-patient confidentiality. Except if I was to hear, let's say, a murder was to take place. Not that I'm saying it would, but if.
So if a client comes in and tells me they're going to kill this person, like then they name them specifically, then I'm obligated to do something. If a client comes in and tells me that they committed murder, I can't tell anybody. You know, it falls under the umbrella of confidentiality. Now, the catch is, and this becomes confusing too, I have to keep clinical notes. So if a person's coming in and telling me all these details about what they're doing, I will, of course, you know, document some of the basics there. And if something were to happen that my records were court-ordered for some sort of litigation of some kind, then there's the potential for them to be outed that way.
So there is a chance that something that a person shared in a therapy session gets out. But occasionally, the tables are turned and clients learn something about their therapists. Charles says he doesn't often run into his clients outside of the office, but recently he got caught in an awkward moment.
A couple of months ago, I was at a restaurant with my wife and my two children. We sat down, and then sitting next to me at the table was a couple that I'd been working with over the course of the last couple of months. And of course, it's those moments when, you know, my 4-year-old son decides to do everything he can to make quite a scene. And it's tough in those moments because it's, you know, you don't get to choose what people know about you.
So you felt forced out as a bad parent?
Of course, yes. You're there to try to help people to make their families and lives better. And I'm showcasing what a terrible parent I am.
Charles Jacob is a psychologist in Philadelphia. He does family and couples counseling. The secret's out. That's what we're talking about on today's show. What happens next? We often keep secrets because we're terrified of what others might think, how they will judge us if they find out. Victoria Elder kept a secret for many years. She felt regret the moment she became a mother, and that feeling never went away. Eventually, she started writing about this, going public. She got lots of attention and support on social media. We caught up with her at her home in Lafayette, Louisiana.
19 years ago, I had a daughter, and I regret becoming her parent. She was beautiful and perfect, and I remember them putting her in my arms, and I'm looking down at her, my eyes staring back up to me so expectantly and so dependent, and realized, oh my God, what have I done? And I think that was the point where the regret started. I was not expected to go to college, even though that's what I wanted to do. My family had it all planned out for me. I was going to finish high school, find a suitable man, get married, and pop out babies. And that was so not what I saw for myself. I just thought I was the worst person in the world at this point. I had never heard anyone say that the moment that they saw their child, they realized that they'd made a mistake and wanted to run away. So I kept it to myself, and I did everything that I could to try to make this whole parenting thing work. I didn't want her to have the life that I had or something worse by not being loved by her mother. And I did absolutely love her, but I hated the job of being a parent. 2 years ago, I discovered a website called Quora. It's a question and answer site. One day, I came across a question asking what it was like to regret becoming a parent. When I saw the question, the first thing that went through my mind was, I'm not sure I really want to answer this question. And then I realized that someone out there was feeling the same way that I had felt, and they needed reassurance that they were normal, that you can do this. You can be a good parent, and you can triumph over this regret that you have. One of the biggest misunderstandings that I came across after the Quora article came out and I shared it with family and friends, one of my aunts read the article and messaged me back later and said, "But you're a good mom." She couldn't understand how I could be a good mom and still hate being a parent. I got a lot of that.
That was Victoria Elder from Louisiana speaking about her regrets after becoming a mother. We spoke with her as she and her daughter Morgan were in the kitchen chopping vegetables for dinner. So how does Morgan feel about all of this?
I don't see it as taboo as everyone makes it out to be.
But Morgan says there's one thing she would change about her mom.
I'd give her thicker hair. Because my mom's always wanted thick hair.
She's absolutely right. She actually looks amazingly like I did at her age, but she got a better nose and she got much thicker hair.
Carrie Spivak produced this piece. Women like Victoria Elder are coming out, saying that motherhood isn't quite right for them, that they regret it. I've seen this issue pop up a lot recently in Facebook groups for moms, for example. But what do we really know about this? How common is it? Sociologist Robin Simon says regret in parenthood is really hard to study.
I don't think most parents would admit to that. I just recently conducted a community study of intensive parenting in a town in the Northeast. And these were long, in-depth interviews where, you know, I had the trust of the parents. You know, they were revealing lots of things. And at the end of the interview, I asked them, you know, do the stress or cost associated with parenthood, you know, does that outweigh, you know, the rewards of having kids? With the exception of one parent, none of these parents talked about that. They felt that the benefits of having kids certainly outweighed, you know, the cost as well as the stress.
So to say, I regret having children, it's even for me, it's just hard saying that out loud.
And I know.
And I do not. But it seems like that would be the ultimate rule that you just cannot break.
I think that the cultural norms are so strong in this regard. You'd be viewed as a deviant. The mother identity has been pretty central to women really throughout our nation's history, I would say, minimally since like the Victorian era. But I would say that parenthood continues to be the most primary identity for women. And I think it's also true for men, as a matter of fact. The parent identity is just so significant and salient.
What good do you think could come out of having a more open conversation about regret around parenthood?
I do think it's useful for parents to talk about the many stressors that are associated with having kids. In fact, I think it would be healthy for our society. I mean, we provide very few social supports, particularly in the, you know, the form of institutional supports for parents. So, you know, it's no wonder why, you know, parents are stressed out, you know, they report lower levels of mental health. They sometimes have more physical health problems than their non-parent counterparts. I think it's not about regret, it's about the failure of American society to provide much needed social supports to parents, particularly parents, working parents who have minor children.
Robin Simon is a sociology professor at Wake Forest University in North Carolina. The secret's out. Now what? That's what we're talking about today. Many workplaces keep open secrets for years, the kind of stuff coworkers whisper about, sexual harassment and violence. These days, with the Me Too movement in full force, we're having a different conversation about this issue, conversations that demand answers and solutions. The science fields are no stranger to this topic. Female scientists have pushed for years to discuss and address harassment, to do something about it. One of them is Heather Flewelling. She's a researcher at the Institute for Astronomy in Honolulu, Hawaii, and she helped start an organization called Astronomy Allies after she was harassed at a conference.
I didn't know what to do. I didn't feel safe.
She says there was something written in the conference program about harassment.
What it wanted you to do was go introduce yourself to very senior scientists in the field that were council members and tell them what happened. And especially for something really sensitive like harassment, it's really intimidating to, as a younger scientist, introduce yourself to someone very prominent and say, hey, I'm having a problem at this conference.
Were you also worried about potential fallout in terms of your career?
Absolutely. I was afraid what would happen, because you see and you hear about what happens when people report problems. And basically, I felt cornered, and I felt that harassment was so problematic for me that if I didn't try to fix it, I would just leave the field, and I didn't want to do that either. So I felt I had nothing to lose.
The organization Heather helped start, Astronomy Allies, they go to big conferences like meetings of the American Astronomical Society, or AAS.
We wear buttons that identify ourselves as astronomy allies. We make sure that people know that we're a safe person, that you can seek mentoring and advice and someone safe you can talk to. We're not mandatory reporters, which means you can talk to us confidently without us reporting anything. Because that was one of the problems I had, was immediately after reporting my incident to the council person, they reported it to the AAS. And maybe you don't know if you want to do that or not yet, but it's good to talk to others before you do that. Also, just being out there makes it more visible that this is a problem that happens. So a lot of times we've had people come up to us and say, oh, I've also experienced harassment. I thought it was just me. I was the only one. So knowing that there's a group out there that's trying to improve this makes it more open and possible to even talk about these sorts of issues.
It's been a couple of years since you started the Allies. Have you seen any changes, any impact?
Yes. So the very first conference that we were at, we could already tell there was a difference. One of the things we offered was safe walks back to the hotels late at night. And a lot of the younger astronomers just assumed that's how it always is. They had no idea it hadn't been done like that before. And a lot of the other astronomers that had been to many of these conferences came up to us and thanked us for what we were doing. And after that first one, the second conference that we were present at, the AAS actually made the anti-harassment policy a lot more detailed, as well as provided prominent signs explaining to people what to do if they experience harassment to make it easier for them to report. Like, they've been open to hearing our suggestions for what we think should change, as well as, because of my activism, I'm now part of the Committee for the Status of Women in Astronomy.
Since you started doing that work, are conferences more work or are they more fun? Do you feel more relaxed?
So a bit of both. So yeah. They are a lot more work because people will come up to us and disclose information and they will want advice from me. But it also feels a lot more fun. One of the things I've noticed is the younger astronomers seem more confident when they're standing by their posters, when they're wandering around the halls. And I thought maybe at first this was because maybe I feel more confident at conferences, but I've heard the same thing from other astronomers as well, that they have noticed the younger astronomers feel a lot more confident and less shy.
That's Heather Flewelling. She's a researcher at the Institute for Astronomy in Honolulu, Hawaii. She's one of the founders of Astronomy Allies. They provide support to people in their field who've experienced harassment. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Growing up in Indonesia, Frank had to keep a part of his life a secret. He's gay, which put him and his family at serious risk as an Islamist extremist group gained a foothold in the area where he lived. He came to the U.S. as a teenager to escape what was happening at home, but there were more struggles ahead. Alex Stern has his story. We're not using Frank's full name. He's worried that it could hurt his immigration process.
A few years ago in high school, Frank fell in love. When I asked him about his boyfriend, he broke into a big smile.
He can be so diplomatic, but he can be so funny too at the same time. When I see people have that kind of personality, it's like melt my heart.
They did the kinds of things teenagers do.
We going to the mall, and then like we playing arcade game and then having dinner.
But at the same time, Frank says his hometown was growing increasingly anti-gay, and that an extremist group called the Islamic Defenders Front started enforcing Sharia law. They made women cover their hair and wear hijab, even women who weren't Muslim. Frank says there was mounting intolerance and violence towards LGBTQ people. Members of the extremist group started to hack into social media accounts to out people. Frank's mom knew he was gay, but no one else did. He didn't feel safe, and he started saving up money to come to the United States.
The reason why I come to America, I just want to be myself, and I don't want to hide anything.
The plan was to leave in a month, but then Frank was discovered on a secret Facebook group for LGBTQ kids.
So I left my home country, and I was like crying in the airplane, like I'm relieved that I can get out from there safely.
Frank landed in Philadelphia by himself. He was 16 years old. He had a visa to take English classes here, and he hoped that he could get another, later, to go to college. He got his own apartment. He started working under the table, at a factory, at a gas station. But eventually he ran out of money.
And I start to figure out, is there any way, like any plan B that I can do?
He couldn't afford classes anymore, which meant he needed a different way to stay in the U.S. He found a pro bono lawyer and learned that to get a new visa, he had to go into foster care. Frank was disappointed with his first foster home as soon as he got there. He'd been hoping for a family, but he and his three foster brothers weren't even allowed to sit on the furniture. His foster mom told him not to act like a girl, which made Frank pretty furious.
Do you think all gay are feminine? Not all of them. Like, gay is broad. Like, sexuality is broad.
His foster brothers bullied him and stole his stuff. Frank says they complained when he talked to his new boyfriend on the phone.
Would you mind telling me like some of the things that they would say to you that made you uncomfortable?
Hey, f***ing f*** hag.
When kids are rejected like this, when their families aren't supportive of their identities, it can be really unhealthy. Caitlin Ryan is the director of the Family Acceptance Project at San Francisco State University, and she's studied this.
And in highly rejecting families, LGBT young people as young adults are more than 8 times as likely to have attempted suicide.
They have way higher rates of depression and drug use, and they're more likely to be homeless. Estimates say about 1 in 5 kids in the U.S. foster system are LGBTQ like Frank, and those kids are twice as likely to say they're being treated poorly. They're more likely to change families, to experience rejection over and over.
I feel like a stranger in a family, so what does it mean? It's worse than like having no family.
Frank knew he had to leave again. He and his caseworker were making other arrangements. Then he was invited to speak at an event encouraging LGBTQ adults to become foster parents for kids like him.
They asked me to share my experience in the foster care, and I shared that. And just like, after I'm done speaking, I met Lee.
I felt like a kindred spirit to him, he looked familiar or something. And I just knew that we were the family he needed.
Lee became Frank's new foster mom. He moved in with her, her wife, and their 8-year-old son.
So this is my room. So I decorate the room. I paint the room by myself. This is my desk, and that's my photos. So this is the photo that I took in New York. This is me and my best friend. And then this is Philadelphia.
Frank painted his room blue. He has a bookshelf filled with books and art supplies and a guitar. He's found a home. And his moms understand him.
When you grow up with a gay parent, you have a lot of things in common and you can be completely open for who you are. You don't have any feels like, oh, I'm worried that it's going to be offensive. I'm worried that it's going to be inappropriate. I'm worried that it's going to be, like, not right or...
disappointing.
Yeah, disappointing for my parents. So it's just something like a bonus that I have for being in a family, like a gay family.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad that it's what feels obvious to me is experienced, that like that you feel like you're in a home where your sexuality is supported and understood. I think that for us, we just see you as a kid, like as a kid that we love and are taking care of.
That was Lee and Frank, foster mom and son. Alex Stern reported this story. Frank recently applied to a bunch of colleges and he's waiting to hear where he got in.
I really want to go to Princeton. That's my dream school. I have a Princeton crew shirt. I have a Princeton hoodie, Princeton hat, like everything about Princeton. So I'm really obsessed.
Don't ever miss a moment of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhorov, and Alan Yu. Our interns are Elizabeth Estrada and Abby Holtzman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager and Alex Stern are our associate producers. Tanya English is the editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care.
Penn Medicine's Heart and Vascular Center supports The Pulse. With community cardiology practices throughout Pennsylvania and New Jersey, Penn's Heart and Vascular Center has made a commitment to deliver advanced treatment options, personalized care, and convenient access close to home. Learn more about Penn's Heart and Vascular Center at pennheart.org or 800-789-PENN. Your life is worth Penn Medicine.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.